kind of guys who'd make you feel like that. Oh no!
Hello, welcome to Tide episode 71 with me, Doug Belshaw.
And me, Di Barnes.
Today in Digital Education is a podcast about educational technology, and therefore sometimes we try new educational technology, as we're going to do in this podcast. But before we do that and we reveal what it is and our experiments and what's going on, how are you doing, Di?
I'm good, actually. I'm really well. I've had a nice weekend because we've had Exie out this weekend, which is basically a long weekend. The children went home midday Friday and then didn't return until the evening on yesterday. So you said
you might do one of two things. You said you might build a standing desk, and you said you might install the Streisand VPN server thing. Did you do either?
I did not do either of those things. So
the best laid plans of mice and men.
Exactly. So I did do bits. So I stayed in Oundle over the 3 days. Lots of people disappear for the long weekend. But I stayed, went for a walk, went to the pub, got drunk, long walk, and then drunk in the pub. It was very nice. And beautiful weather over the weekend. Went for a run with my housemaster and his dog, and played football, and did some sleeping, and did lots of little bits of work, which was great. You know, it's good to sort of have some space to do some work. But I didn't do either of those two things.
No, it's good. As you say, it's good to be able to decompress sometimes, which I guess is the whole point of Exeat, and you know, having a little bit of respite before.
Yeah, so we're one of the only schools in the country that does 6 weeks boarding straight, so like five full weekends, and that's it's called in the circuit by the pupils hardcore boarding, and so I think we're actually reducing that now, so we're going to have an Exeat, so it's just 3 weeks. Chunks.
Oh, I see. Right. Okay.
Mostly, and which is very welcome because it does take it out if you're working in the way that we work.
I can imagine. Yeah. Yeah. Well, as we record this, I am in Southampton, and I've just arrived here and opened my laptop and got connected and all that kind of stuff. And as we've just been messaging each other on the way, I didn't really understand. You know, you can hear people whinging on about things like Southern trains in the UK, and you think, oh, how bad can it be? But today, on the way to Lewes, which is where Sussex Downs College has one of their campuses, where Brian Mathers and I did a thinkathon as We Are Open Co-op, on the way there, it was horrendous, and getting then from there to Southampton was awful as well, just randomly cancelled trains, putting trains together, last-minute changes, mass confusion. So it must just be a ball of stress for everybody going to work and coming back from work every day.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I think people who live in commuter world in that area, they're in for a hard gig, basically. It suits some people because they get to listen to Tide.
indeed.
Whereas they wouldn't in any other place. So,
yes, it makes me very grateful to live in kind of in the Northeast, where not only is I don't have to do any commuting and stuff, but house prices are cheaper, etc. So yeah, we'll get on to what I'm doing this week, I guess, later on. But I'm glad you had a good weekend, and it's always good to have a kind of a de-stressing period. I got FIFA 17 in the Black Friday sale, as I said I was going to.
Oh, right, okay.
So I've been playing a bit of that. It was only 25 quid, so.
That's good. I've looked at the Black Friday stuff and it's been coming through, and I've been tempted like to buy a new TV. I resisted. That was good. I don't really need a new TV, so it's kind of all right. But the other thing that really tempted me, I think the product that I really want, that I don't need, is Google Home or Amazon Echo.
Really? Why do you fancy that?
Well, I very nearly pushed the button on Amazon Echo, and I didn't. Because it was 30% off or whatever, but I just like the idea. I mean, I live alone, so the idea of being able to talk to a machine and it will give me answers back audibly is quite nice.
Have you seen? You know, we're talking about the film Her that you recommended to me.
I do. Yes.
Have you seen that? The Sony the version one of the Sony of what Sony thinks that might look like in the future is released early next month.
Oh, really? No, I didn't see that.
Yeah, it's called the Sony Xperia Ear. not the sexiest name, I have to say, when, you know, in the film it's Scarlett Johansson doing the voice. But it goes in one ear and it does some of the stuff that's, yeah, so.
Well, I think that's, so I think it's interesting because I really do think, I mean, you know, I've been playing about with voice a little bit, voice input into computers, and I've been a fan of it for a while, but just it hasn't been up there, but it is catching up. And if there are certain things that I can do using a device like that, particularly turning radio stations on, putting certain songs on, that kind of thing, and you hook up the device to a good speaker or a system of some sort, and I quite like the idea of being able to just call out a song and rather than go to your device and go through that workflow of, like, you know, pressing your screen and whatever and choosing what it is you're doing, typing in some keys. I just like the idea of being able to think of a tune, you know, and what an earworm people call it, and then when you get something in your head. And
I just, you know, because I think it's today, was it, that the IP bill was signed into law, you know, what we were talking about last week, so it's now an act of parliament, the Queen's given it the royal assent, etc. The idea of there being, I know we've talked about basically our mobile phones recording, potentially recording everything that we do, but just the idea of there being a listening device, it's fair enough if it's my personal mobile phone, but a listening device in the home when I've got kids there and stuff, and it potentially recording my family life and, like, spooks being able to turn that on and off at will just seems a bit...
I completely agree. I had a really interesting conversation with friends of mine last night, and they had been traveling around at the weekend visiting family and things, and in the conversations that they'd had, they've been talking about weird things, one of the quick things being, are white cats deaf? So when they went to look this up, it seems quite random, doesn't it, when they went to look this up on Google, when they put in are white, and then the suggestions, the auto completes are cats deaf kind of thing. So they, and then they were looking up how many episodes there were in particular in The Missing, which is an excellent TV show on BBC at the moment, finishes tomorrow night. Mm. And they were looking how many episodes there were to make sure that they were, like, just one episode from the end. And again, The Missing came up, and they've been talking about it before they actually looked it up on Google on their handsets. And they believed that Google were actually listening to their conversation and therefore knew what to auto-predict. In the things, and we were discussing that sort of balance in
well, it's entirely possible. I think what's more likely in the sense of Guy Debord's The Society of the Spectacle is that the market and the spectacle, as he describes, which is a hard thing to explain without kind of going into French philosophy, is around us, and therefore we communicate with each other through symbols. And I was really thinking about this the other day when my wife and I were using Signal, because I was on Jersey and I can use the Signal encrypted Wi-Fi calling thing. And she discovered GIFs on there and we were just communicating in GIFs. And I realized that we were communicating through culturally appropriated snippets of other people's lives, if you see what I mean. And it just seemed bizarre, but also quite fun.
Yeah, well, I think this is the thing. So my take on it is that I am privacy conscious, but I'm not privacy. Paranoid. So I kind of think I'd like to see what the functionality of these devices is. I'm more interested in it as an input method than I am in, at least for a while, in protect. I'd like to see how well it performs and how well it actually augments my life, if you like, and suits what I want, because I do think that voice is becoming more and more a usable input methodology.
You don't have to be an American male anymore to be able to use it, yeah?
No, exactly. And it's just really, you know, it is really, really good in the way that they can detect and interpret what it is that you want to say based on your vocabulary that they have stored up in the cloud. And all of that kind of thing. I am really, really wary of something that is always on listening, recording potentially everything.
I think you've seen, haven't you, and Oliver Quinlan's tweeted and stuff about there's a Raspberry Pi version of what Echo. You just described. Yeah, but you have to, I mean, the clunky thing is that you can't just go, hey, Alexa, or whatever. You have to press a button to make it start listening. But then I guess that's more privacy aware.
Well, yeah, it is more privacy aware, absolutely. And I think I just want to see if I can make it work for me. And I, part of the reason that I would do it, I don't think I'd do it if I lived with other people. And because I don't have conversations other than the one that you and I have, which goes out live, but I don't have many conversations in my flats. It's just me. Right. So, so I don't really have anything to hide, in that way. And I'm just really curious about, you know, so I looked at watches and I thought I've toyed with the idea of getting some kind of wrist attachment, that would, help me, streamline notifications and bring my attention to the things I need my attention brought to, without always getting my phone out of my pocket. And but I haven't opted to purchase one. But I think this might be just me in my flat and the different things that I do. I think it might really work.
But I have to say, everyone's got different use cases. And for you, in your position, I guess you need to be experimenting with new tech that your pupils might get their hands on, so that you can be aware of potential implications for safeguarding and all that kind of stuff as well.
Yeah, very much so. And I'm a big believer as well, is what things that you're paranoid about, it's best to sort of stare them in the face and look at them and you actually use them and see what's going on, even though you can never really identify what data it is that's held about you, wherever it's held, you know.
Indeed, indeed. Cool. Well, yeah, so the Black Friday deals wise, I stayed at Brian Mather's house last night. Thanks again, Brian. And he was in his man shed when I arrived, and his wife called him in, and then I went out with him, and he bought, and I don't think you mind me mentioning, he got a really good deal, like half price, on this gorgeous, super high resolution 28-inch Dell widescreen monitor, and it is a thing of beauty. And given the work that he does around visual thinkery and illustrations and things, he color matched it, you know, the color profile to his MacBook, and it was just a thing of beauty.
Oh, well, that's quite interesting, because I'm sitting in front of one of those right now.
Really?
Did you? That's what I use. Oh. I didn't buy one. No, the school bought it for me. Okay. But it's the monitor I use with my MacBook. But interestingly, I had coffee this afternoon with Dick Taylor. Hello, yeah. Dick, if you're listening. And who is based near Arundel in a town called Ashton, a village called Ashton. And so he invited me up for coffee, and it's nice to have a chat. And he's an ed tech sort of venture capitalist, for want of a better word. He's invested he's invested in about five different ed tech companies, sponsored the first few teach meets with Ewan McIntosh up in Scotland and things like that.
I wonder if he'd like to sponsor Tide.
I wonder. He says he doesn't sponsor any more teach meets because they sort of, well, it's a long story, but they've got too big and out of control.
Yeah, but this, we're talking about high class and you and me. Anyway, moving on.
So he's meeting up just before bed. He's meeting up with the head of Dell, like the head. Oh, so right. He said, "Do you want to have a drink with him?" And so the head of Dell, I said invite him down, have a look at the Dell products that we have in the school, because we use Dell all in ones. So we have about 100 of those knocking around the school. So I said he wants to come and see them in the school, and then we can have a drink and have a chat about what they'll do.
So this guy is going to Dick's house, not like they're meeting at Bet.
No, they are meeting at Bet, and he's going to spend the week at Bet, but he's coming the weekend earlier, and they're friends. So
are you going to Bet?
I'm not sure yet. So I'd quite like to, because I always like to catch up with other people that go there. But I'm not sure what benefit there is for me in going there. So I catch up with current suppliers and things like that and talk about their latest, developments and look at our systems and that kind of thing, which is always really nice. But last year I took the digital leaders, and I quite like, they really enjoyed it, and they quite like to go again, but I'm not really sure I can, I can spin it, if you know what I mean. I can make it happen, but I'm not sure I have the actual value in them going, other than experiencing a big ed tech or technology exhibition. Mm. And seeing what that's like and getting that experience.
We met up there last year, didn't we?
We did, yeah.
And I have to say, that was the most enjoyable Bet I'd been to. And I spoke a couple of times, I think. And I mean, I've spoken every time I've been to Bet, I think. And usually Bet phone me up and they get some new person saying, "Have you heard about Bet?" And I was like, "Yes, you phone me up every year to give me, you know, to ask my advice." As they must do for lots of people. But this year that hasn't happened, and they haven't been asked to speak. So I'm wondering if I should just go down anyway, not because I give a flying toss about the vendors, to be quite honest, or many of the keynote speakers, although I'm sure there'll be some wonderful people there, but to meet up with people, because it's a good kind of honeypot for people to come along to, and a place that people can get out of their current work situations to go to. That being said, I did put an idle thought into the We Are Open Slack channel, the members bit, which I guess only Brian, Laura, John and I can see. And I said, well, how about we use like YouTube Live or Periscope and go around filming each other asking really awkward questions about openness, open source, free software, etc., to like the hardcore capitalist, venture capitalist backed software companies. And
what did they say?
I think everyone was up for it in principle. Whether we'll actually do it in practice is
I mean, you know what answers you're going to get, don't you? This is the thing, isn't it? So you're going to this essentially big money making exhibition, and where they're just out there to try and get people to make their money. Yeah. Actually, speaking of Dick Taylor, he's really interesting on the. I mean, we talked about him before. He's really interesting on the whole edtech making money, corporate thing, and that teachers aren't involved in the development of products, and et cetera, and they always end up failing, and they want.
Yeah. It'll be a bit too much like. And a less funny version of the Ali G show.
It would. That's an accurate description, I think.
I think so.
But still might be, I still think that, I mean, there is value going down there to sort of keep your ear to the ground, see what's there, but you don't, I mean, last year, the thing I was really impressed by technology-wise was the Microsoft Hub, I think it's called, which is this fantastic touchscreen, which is capacitive, so it works as well as your phone does or whatever. And it's 84 inches in diagonal.
Or on the wall?
Yeah, yeah, and has four cameras embedded into it so that it can film you doing the presentation no matter where you are standing in front of the board.
Yeah, but again, I mean, we've talked about this before. Just these things extend the teacher bubble, don't they, rather than...
Oh, yeah, no, it had its... But it was a really smashing piece of kit, but I agree with you, yeah. It's not about... I think one of the points is that really what you know how people talk about pedagogy, people, you need to talk about pedagogy before you talk about tech kind of thing when you're trying to transform or
yeah, but these companies, and I'm not going to tar them all with the same brush, but I guess a lot of them will use the language which people are, you know, possibly less, more excitable, less reflective, less cynical people possibly than you and I will see the same words as they see on Twitter with progressive educators being bandied around by this, you know, companies at BET and elsewhere, and think they're actually the words are signifying the same thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've talked about open washing with the likes of Pearson and Blackboard and things, and it's a similar kind of situation here. Like, everybody agrees that pedagogy comes first, and I'm sure the ex-teachers who work for technology companies are pushing for the same things within the organization. It's just that, unfortunately, money's often and it has to be the bottom line. Yeah. Anyway, so I guess the answer is a maybe for BET for both of us.
Yes, no, I'm not decided yet.
Cool. Right, so let's, moving swiftly on, do you want to introduce what we're using this week and what the experiment is?
Okay, so you found this app from somewhere or other, although I do believe I've seen it before.
Have seen it before. We have discussed it before. It's just that it seems like it's one of those things where maybe its time has come. I don't know.
Okay, well, so the app's called Anchor, and it's an audio recording app, and you have a 2-minute segment of audio that you can record, and you kind of ask a question or do whatever, and then people can connect to that and reply. So you sent, you asked a question, which was something out of the Tide Slack channel that somebody had given, as we promised we would do in episode 71, following on from episode 70, where we looked at the October feedback. And then different people who saw that, so I replied, and then other people could reply as well. We had Stefan in there. Hello, Stefan, if you're listening. And Tony in there. Hello, Tony. And anyone else?
There's been a range of responses. It's been good. And... Okay. I mean, last week, episode 70, it was just you and I discussing it and taking things from the Slack channel and things, and this seemed to be a way to do more participation. So a podcast that we haven't mentioned yet, and I haven't had any kind of interaction with Sophie, I think she worked for the people who make BET or something like that. Mm-hmm. I've forgotten her surname, sorry, but she does the EdTech podcast.
She was at the Firefly conference. She was chairing a panel at the Firefly
conference. Yeah, she seems... I have to say, I haven't listened to any of them yet. But she...
I have, they're good.
Yeah, so there'll be high production values, I'm sure, much higher than us. But, She interviews vendors and people involved in ed tech and all that kind of stuff. So great stuff. But I did notice, because I follow on Twitter and it imports your followers from there, that she was using it to capture responses and what people thought and comments on podcasts that had already been received. And I guess that she'll then weave those into the next episode, which I thought was a nice thing to do. With this one, we're recording this through Skype as we usually do, the intro and the outro, and then you can export, you can choose which, so like on, it has like almost threaded comments.
Which, so it's a bit like Storify, but with audio. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think so. It's not, yeah. I was going to use a Twitter analogy, but yeah, it is more like Storify. Uh-huh. And then my understanding is that you can then choose which responses to your initial prompt you want to include. You can select them, and then you can export that as a M4A file, I think, which we can then put in the middle of this podcast. So I will export that now or soon after this, and then you'll get responses from all kinds of people, and there'll be a little noise, I guess, in between each response, and we'll see how it goes. I mean, it might be a nice way of recording podcasts, or it might just be a way of capturing people's responses, but for this one, we'll see how it goes, and then 2017, who knows?
Well, I think so. I think it's worth, it's an idea worth iterating on. I think it's got legs, basically. And whereas episode 71 won't be the holy grail of what you want to achieve in a podcast, it's certainly a way of experimenting with a piece of technology that facilitates a certain function that we can weave into the podcast, but would also get people who listen to Tide, they can get to do little 60-second contributions and expand the conversation that way, maybe.
I think it's fair to say that Tide will never be the holy grail in what you want from a podcast.
I disagree, right? So this is interesting. Dick Taylor, no less, said to me two things about Tide. One, and he does listen to it. I don't know if he listens to the whole thing every week, but he is a regular listener of sorts.
Right.
And he said, have you ever thought of doing it as a video? Because video is more suited to how he consumes this sort of thing.
I do this naked every week, so how would that work?
You say that. I wouldn't put myself on video doing this because of that particular reason. You know, I'm often in my dressing gown or whatever. So that was one thing. And the other thing he said is that listening to Tide should be compulsory professional development for teachers.
Hey, we need that quotation on our website ASAP.
Across the land. And I was just like, and he said the thing is because the way that we talk about education was really insightful, he felt. So I discussed Tide because, you know, we're not changing Tide for anyone other than what we feel is a good thing to do. You know, yes. that's why we're here. It's about it being loyal to its purpose and our motivation, I think. But yeah, interesting idea, I thought, because there are lots of podcasts out there discussing ed tech stuff, and we do this in a way, and it's, you know, it's a bit sort of clumsy and chaotic often, and
long, and people whinge about it being long.
They do, don't they? And we're really sorry it's so long, but the conversation just is the conversation. We naturally get to a certain point, and we're not very disciplined about curbing what we're saying, because I feel that it's like there's a little sort of exponential build going on within each separate conversation, within the longer conversation, and it's often toward the end of that you get the sort of bulb of the curve of really what the quality of what we might speak about is.
There's that, and the fact that we like the sound of our own voices.
Yeah, that's true.
Right, so without further ado, he says, being quite far into this podcast already, let's listen to what various people have to say. I guess this is me introducing the stream, and anything else to say before we let them take it away, I guess, and then come back at the end?
No, the doorbell's just rang, which means a pupil needs to see me, so this is perfectly convenient.
Boom, there we go.
Enjoy Anchor.
Hello, welcome to Tide episode 71 with me, Doug Belshaw, using Anchor. So what we're going to do this week, because I'm traveling quite a lot, Di is going to respond to these messages, as can anybody who is using Anchor, anchor.fm. It's an app which you can record audio replies to. And what we're going to do is we're going to use some of the questions from Slack. So the first one to respond to is from the Slack channel, which you can find more details at tidepodcast.org. And the first thing we're going to talk about is having a landing page
Do you have one? Why do you have one? And why would people want to find out more about you? How do you structure it? Do you host it yourself? What service do you use?
Hey, Doug, I use a landing page, and I, at the moment, mine is built on GitHub. I built it on, and it's at diebarnes.info. And on that, I just have links to all the sorts of things that I do at different places online. And I'm not sure how necessary it is really, but I think it's a good way to hold together everybody's my idea of what I want people to see when they find me. So quite clearly, diebarnes.info is the root of my site on the internet, and they can go and find out about my identity and the different things that I do as defined by me, rather than going for hunting for random things out there on the web. I used to use about.me, but I dropped that just because I wanted to own it for myself and for my identity to be controlled completely by me. That's it.
Hi, Dar. Yeah, I used to use about.me as well, as you know. And interestingly, when I got rid of that, someone else jumped on it and used it because it had some Google juice. And I've actually used, you know, that Google thing where you can complain under EU legislation and have results removed from Google. I actually complained about that because it was using my name but linking it to a betting site. So that's an interesting use of that legislation. In terms of owning your own domain, absolutely. I don't use Git, actually. I probably should do. But I actually just use the Reclaim hosting, web hosting. And one thing that is important, I think, is making all of your stuff easily searchable. And I don't do that at the moment. So I've got multiple different blogs around the web, and I'm going to make some kind of maybe Google or some other kind of custom search so that people can easily find what they can remember of the stuff I've written.
Hi, Doug. My name is Phil Pitcher. I work with Di Barnes. I'm a relatively new teacher. I've been teaching for just over 2 years. My subject's geography, and I have a site, picturegeography.co.uk, which is hosted through Site Builder, and it's just as a means as a new teacher to create a bit of a profile for myself and to draw together my resources, my thoughts, my blogs, my images, and just to start to create a bit of an online profile.
Thanks, Phil. I did something similar actually when I started teaching. So I had a website at mrbelshaw.co.uk. I kind of divide it into teaching resources and also a bit for the students. I guess the bit for the students isn't so necessary anymore, given they have things like Google Apps and Microsoft 365. But it's definitely a great idea to establish an identity which is separate from your school, because you don't want to be having a corporate identity. So for me, I've had the same identity, I guess, even though I've had multiple different places to work in different sectors. So definitely for me, owning your own space online, having a space to put resources, super important.
Hi, Doug and Di. It's really nice to hear you using Anchor. This is Stefan, aka at Dots and Spaces. So I listen to Tide. Usually takes me a week to listen to a single episode. I do it in little chunks, 20-minute commutes, morning and evening, on my way to and from work. So in terms of a landing page, this is like the Holy Grail. It'd be really nice to have somewhere where all the little bits of my kind of online identity kind of lived, or sort of were sort of could see it a bit like a kind of London tube map of all my kind of online domains and places that I visit and all the little traces that I leave. But I'm going to be a bit contentious and say that Google kind of does that for me. So who knows?
So, Stefan, what I would say about that is that you might rely on Google to find stuff or your favorite search provider. I often do this because my stuff's on all different blogs, and I search for my own name and then anything I can remember from the thing I wrote, or someone else for that matter. But you've got to remember that Google, it's got some great tools in there and stuff, but they're not politically neutral. They don't even have that phrase, you know, don't be evil and stuff. So I know I mentioned the Google custom search, but really what we need to be doing is providing a canonical link to our highlights, our greatest hits. That's what I'd say. But yeah, search the search approach rather than the Yahoo directory approach from back in the day. It's probably a good option, but we should probably ensure that we've got a multiplicity of sources.
Hi, Doug. I think you're absolutely right, and Google certainly isn't neutral, and it's certainly not living by its do no evil mission statement. So, yeah, I think doing something on GitHub that Dai suggests is a really good idea. I think that would be a really quite neutral place to put up a landing page. And I think one of the issues is that people will Google me, and I can't stop them doing that. And that's going to be, for many people, the way that they access all the things that I do online on all those parts. And maybe I really need to get better control of the sorts of things that people are seeing. The second thing, just quickly, is thinking about if I did create a new landing page, what I might put on there. So not just links to social networks and things that I do, but also maybe there's an element of curation about things that I want people to see. So it's a great discussion. Keep it going.
Hi, Stefan and Doug. Definitely an interesting topic, Google versus private personal ownership. It's important to have a landing page, I think, and I encourage my students to create one, whether it's in a blog or a website or their own domain. But the ultimate look at the purpose of the landing page is to just have your personal, professional, digital presence all in one place so people can find you and can learn what you're all about in terms of your interests, your passions, and what brings you into digital technology spaces.
All right, so the next thing to think about is, how does this apply to students? So we've got our own kind of domain, our own presence online, our own landing page. Do students need that while they're at school, at university? Should they have a domain of one's own? What should that look like? My own view would be that students perhaps should be having a domain of one's own, and we should be transitioning to an email address they can have for life. Certainly by when they're in year 11, so that's when they're 16, but given that they have to stay in UK education until they're 18, maybe it's a sixth form thing, I'm not sure. So what do people think about that, about students' domains and students' landing pages?
I think that's a really good idea. I think one of the things when I was teaching in FE and I sort of moved into HE was meeting students later who said that they still had the Flickr account or the Google Docs kind of, or the Google Drive account that they had that we started together or, in class. And it was great because it had given them sort of continuity throughout, and that they'd been able to go back and they had this sort of record of everything that they'd done. So and you know, we talked earlier about how it would be great to sort of leave the kind of Googleverse and set up its own thing. So to have a domain of one's own and to get that started as early as possible would be really good, and start to populate it with tools and start to think about that. I think that would be the way to go.
Hi, it's Tony Shepherd here. The conversation about portfolios and having a movable presence for students have been going around for years, and nobody ever really came up with a suitable and concrete answer. Where you've got folk like Google and Microsoft who are saying that actually when you get given an email address that can be migrated over to an alumni address or something similar, it's possibly the closest you can get at the moment, short of anybody coming up with their own web space. To some extent, using GitHub is a good way to go for that side of things. Vanity domains, for me, aren't vanity domains. Sometimes it's actually about making sure you've got a fixed place for your presence. There's no one single answer, so I think it's just a case of mix and match, to be honest.
I think that's right, Tony. I think that what it's our job to do, and I think it's something that Stefan's identifying, is that pupils or students feel value after the fact from doing things like this, from learning how to create a presence on the web that they maintain. And the idea that they can actually do that in their own identity is a good thing. But what I find as a school teacher is that you can push too soon to get these things up online in the pupil's own identity. And it's an interesting thing that Doug says, is that we should pick a time by which they publish or claim their own identity online. I think that's an interesting question. But really what I think is most important is you just get them online and sharing.
It's interesting what Tony was saying there about it not really mattering about what it is and vanity URLs. I've never really heard people talk about domain of one's own as a vanity URL, but I guess it is, yeah, at the end of the day. What Di's saying there about a certain time which you publish, what I guess I'd like to see is a similar kind of approach to bring your own device or bring your own browser. What would BYO what? Bring your own domain? Bring your own email address? Like, what could we do which would make sure we are within the whole duty of care remit? We can make sure that bad things aren't happening, but at the same time giving students choice.
One of the things I've always encouraged is instead of having a Follow Friday, hashtag FF, for fellow teachers, fellow educators and whatnot, to have a Follow Friday for students. So if a student already has a web presence, for example, my students have Twitter accounts and blogs, to amplify those, because we probably have a stronger network than they do. Sometimes, you know, and students have YouTube channels as well and make videos, and so I'll amplify those. There's been a few times in conferences where I've included a student's video production, and so many people just love it and want to see it, and they actually tweet that student, and the student feels really excited about it. So I think for the younger years, before they really have a web presence, it might be interesting to just shift this whole concept of I'm producing work just for the teacher's eyes.
Hi, Amy. I'm just reflecting on that shift from teacher to student. And one of the things that I used to do whilst we would set up, a Facebook group or a Google Hangout or a Flickr group, what else did we use? A YouTube channel, for instance. So we might have that for the duration of the course. And then, you know, there came a point where I would kind of, as the teacher, have to sort of back out of the room, as it were, and let them get on with it. And I think that was like the right thing to do, really. And you're right. So that then became their network and their way of sharing and their way of getting in touch. And, you know, that really wasn't the space for me anymore. So, and there was a certain joy in being able to do that, being able to kind of, you know, leave at the right moment, as it were.
I think these are both really interesting points, Stefan and Amy. And it's this, I think it's a balance for every teacher to strike according to the context within which they work. So we all have certain relationships with the different pupils within different classes even. And we can use our networks to sort of amplify that. And it's sort of nice to have a Follow Friday. But certainly for a lot of my network, if my network gets inundated with pupil blogs and things like that, I get a bit sort of tired of that because it's not what I'm there for unless I'm interested in actually what the pupil is sharing or talking about, what the teacher is sharing on the pupil's behalf. But then equally, sometimes it's quite a powerful way, and I know that I'll use my network to amplify sort of good blog posts that my pupils have written and things like that at the same time. So I think it's a balance that has to be struck for each individual.
Hi, Amy. I really love the idea of students following others, building their digital presence by engaging in some way. I encourage my students to follow each other's blogs, for example, and follow each other on Twitter. They often start with what's familiar and what's known, and then they start reaching out to others. I encourage them to follow other blog writers that they may meet or read in the duration of the course. It's this notion of a gradual release from ownership, but that they have the control and make the decisions about who and where and when to follow. Thanks.
Hi, Di. I was particularly interested in your comment around the timing of students developing online identities. As a secondary principal, I am particularly concerned about the relationship between digital identities, physical identities, and mental health in adolescence. I know that so many of my students have their sense of self-worth tied to things like the number of likes they get on their selfies. And I think as a school system, we haven't done a particularly good job in scaffolding and supporting students in developing those digital identities. And I wonder how we might do a better job of that. So I wonder then, if we are working to help students publish work, to own their own domain, to have a place on the web, to demonstrate who they are in a more professional way, if that might have an impact on some of the negative digital identity things that we're seeing in adolescence right now. I don't know, but I had just never really connected the two until you talked about when in the age sequence, what's the sequencing of helping students publish online, and whether or not that kind of support might do good things for how they enter the digital environment in their adolescence. I don't know.
Hi, Donna. I go back further than adolescence, to be honest, and we look at how we help early years and foundation learn to play and experience their environment. So we control what they may play with and where they may play. And that's the same way with their digital identity to some extent. They play within a particular playground when they're in the reception, and they then slowly move into shared playgrounds with other year groups. And in the same way in schools with their digital identity, they start off within a walled garden, just purely within their class, and then within their school, and then looking to create a community. The only thing is no one's ever really mapped that out, from what I've seen, to have a look at the impact on mental health, on growth, on any other bits and pieces. I'd be interested to see that element of things if anybody decides to do the research on it.
All right, so next question. In kind of riffing on that bring your own device theme, then what about laptop purchasing or iPad or tablet purchasing advice for pupils and parents and teachers? I know Di's been doing some work on this recently. I was in a school last week, a primary school, that tried to give pretty generic advice. You can't really tell them to buy specific laptops, I guess. But they had a tripartite model of bring almost anything you want within these guidelines, renting them from the school, or borrowing a limited supply from school as well. And that seemed to be working quite well. I think they were 10 years into that program. What do people think about that? What advice would you give? What constraints would you put upon a bring-your-own-device kind of policy?
I think that's an interesting concept, Doug. The document I'm putting together is to provide advice to parents who are purchasing laptops and as well as teachers, I guess, and just looking at all the different features and characteristics of the different devices you get out there, like battery life and solid state storage and things like that, that are important and what you're getting for your money. But it's quite a difficult thing to do, like putting together a matrix of the benefits and drawbacks of each device for them to make an informed decision. And we don't have a recommended set of devices for people to choose from for bringing their own device here. We don't have a formal bring your own device policy. It's all very informal, but it's done, if you see what I mean. I don't know. I know that some schools are doing inking devices as their benchmark. So anything that allows inking, like Microsoft Surface and that kind of thing. Yeah, but it's an interesting conversation. The documents, my documents, are on the Slack channel.
So I actually think there's a gap in the market here for people to be trusted advisors for this kind of stuff and have always up-to-date things. In the US, they have a thing a bit like Which in the UK. I think it's called Consumer Reports. And the idea is it's got the pros and the cons, but you just need something simple, like a table, like Di said. Something which gives you an overview of things which are a decent price point, have good features, and, yeah, informed decisions. I wonder who could do that.
I was talking yesterday, actually, in relevance to with Dick Taylor, and he was talking about getting people who are expert to advise parents. So when parents are a bit lost as to how to help their children make the best out of school, particularly if they're in an underperforming school that they don't believe is going to get the best out of their children, is where would they go for advice? Just to sort of say this is a good MOOC to do or whatever, to, you know, to help them out and point their kids in the right direction without paying for their own tutors for everything. But interestingly, this would be a similar sort of service, the sort of thing that Bechter would have done back in the day. Maybe NACE could do it. I don't know.
It's interesting what you say there, Di, about organisations like Bechter and NACE. I'd also include people like Tablet Academy and even some suppliers in there as well. Because quite often, bring your own device or bring your own technology is sometimes seen as a silver bullet without people realising, well, actually, what's the gun that we're going to be using? As far as I'm concerned, the gun is the educational requirements, and unless you know those to start with, you're really going to struggle as to define what technology is going to be best suited. I have a declare an interest here. I work for a mobile device management provider now, and when we work with schools, we have to be very careful about explaining what technologies can and can't be managed or supported. And people need to remember that there are other things, such as VLEs, email systems, online drives, that are used as part of the whole parcel.
So, Tony, what a great point about having teachers who really understand the curriculum and what learning needs to take place. So when you have an environment where kids are allowed to bring their own devices, and you have some devices that are provided by the school, and you also have the opportunity for students to sign out the devices that they want to use, and if you have a teacher who deeply understands the curriculum and really understands that kids can both learn in many different ways and demonstrate their learning in many different ways, you're creating such a rich environment where students have opportunities to choose the tools that best work for them to both learn and demonstrate learning. But with BYOD, they get a chance to watch other students work. So they get a chance, an opportunity to see the workflow of other students and learn about other tools.
I think these are both great points, Tony and Donna. And it shows how complicated this sort of thing can get. And you have to sort of be clear in what it is that you want. So in my school, I want to push for a sort of mixed environment where different devices are welcome and different practices welcome between the teachers as well as between the pupils and the teachers, if you see what I mean. And because everyone can see the different technologies at work and what different influence they can have. And so you have to kind of reduce that, the gun, the silver bullet, as it were, to the browser, and the gun, as Tony said, always be the educational drivers of what it is that you want to achieve, and so the technology can become invisible and kind of disappear, but people just get on with it and use it, but learn from each other's different kind of practices, the different ways there are to crack the same nut, you know. All good.
Okay. Well, we hope you enjoyed that. Doug and I haven't actually heard what that's going to sound like yet, because we won't hear it until the podcast is produced and published. So that's quite a nice thing. Hopefully that was good. And
I think it's going to be all gold.
Do you think it all gold?
All of it.
Like Terry's?
Yes, absolutely. Dark chocolate. Terry's all
gold. Dark chocolate, yes. Absolutely. Everyone's a winner. But so hopefully that was good.
I find it interesting, because I've been listening to some of these as we go along, trying to imagine where people are. So Tony Shepherd, I did hear his, and he was like almost under the desk at work going, well, guys, if I can just, and like that kind of stuff.
The hidden tiger.
Yeah, hidden tiger, crouching dragon.
No, it wasn't. If any, for reference to those listening and don't know Tony, Tony goes under Grumbleduke on Twitter and elsewhere, and on the Slack channel as well. And he has his profile picture has tiger makeup on, like full Monty Tiger face, and he attends Bet like that and other things like that. So Tony is known for his tiger face.
Yes.
Anyway. So hopefully that was good. Any feedback people want to send, do send it on the Slack channel or on Twitter or whatever. Let us know if you think that's a good way to sort of, it's a good thing to include in the podcast, and whether it's something you'd like more of. I don't know.
Yeah, if you've got some feedback for me, you can send it to Di, actually.
Yeah, send it to me. I'll send it to Doug. That's fine.
Because I'm not going to be here. I'm going to be somewhere else for December, as I usually am. So for those who don't know, I've got a mate who works at Google, who I used to go to the same church as back in Newcastle. And he Paul Lewis, so he called, when I said I was having a digital hiatus, he's like, oh, it's almost like Belshaw Black Ops, isn't it? So that's what I call it now. So this will be my sixth year. I had a bit of time off in the summer, but December is the main one for me. Because it, you know, it's dark and it's whatever. So I take time off social media, no blogs, no newsletters, etc. But I am doing work, so there might be the occasional blog that you see with my name on that I've either written this month, or it's just stuff that I'm getting paid for, so I'm doing that as usual. And then I'm still responding to emails and stuff on my work email address, which if you find, feel free to say hello, but make sure it's work-related, please. And then I will be back in January, hopefully raring to go as I usually am and thinking differently about the world and also having decompressed and stopped thinking in 140 characters.
Yeah, no. And so two things to say about that. One is that if you're familiar with Doug and his Black Ops behavior, you'll realize he always comes back with something slightly different. So he's rethought some of his tech habits while he's away and his setup and that sort of thing, which is always interesting to see, having had that time for reflection. But also for Christmas this year, it'd be really good just to spam Doug's work email address.
You cheeky bagger.
Every day, just set a reminder. Automate it, people. Come on.
You're going on my blacklist right now, Barnes.
Excellent. Okay, Doug, what are you up to this week?
This week, so I said at the start of the podcast, I'm in Southampton looking out the window now over onto the train station from my hotel and seeing the lights of Southampton. Tomorrow, I am flying from Southampton to Jersey. So at the moment, I've been flying Newcastle, Southampton, Jersey. So I just cancelled the Newcastle to Southampton part of that flight with Victoria College Thursday, Friday. And then, next week. So, yeah, just up until Christmas, what am I doing? So you can probably go through this as well, Di. Next week, excitingly, we've got our first in-person We Are Open planning session from Wednesday to Friday. We're holding it at Brian's house. We're also having a meetup in South London at the London... Oh, what's it called? The London Distillery?
Distillery, something like that, yeah.
Yeah, I'll put the link into the show notes. That's on Thursday the 8th. In the evening, exact details to follow, where people who are interested in meeting us in real life in Meet Space can do so. Anyone interested in joining our co-op, because we're going to be opening our doors to new members soon, and also people who are just interested in kind of platform co-ops and tech co-ops and stuff in general and just want to chat. It's a nice space. It's a group of dads who decided to convert a big old garage into a distillery and a like a brewery. So it's an interesting place. I'll be there doing that work. And we're doing some work with Freeformers. Have you come across them?
No.
Freeformers kind of train young people in digital stuff. They've got a new thing called Freeformers Academy, which is placing young people in three different organizations, including Freeformers, I understand. And we're going to be doing some work helping them conceptualize and move that forward, which will be exciting. I'm hopefully helping Victoria College with their interview process for their new, well, basically your role at their school. Mm-hmm. And then up until Christmas, I'm still available for a bit of work. I might be in Cambridge doing a lot of writing and hopefully just able to stop working so I can decompress, think, and enjoy Christmas. How about you?
Good. Well, first of all, let me ask, when the co-op meeting on Thursday, what time are you open to visitors?
That's a good question that has an answer. So I've asked this question of my colleagues, and let's see if an answer is forthcoming. I've put, do we have a start time? And no one's really answered me, apart from sending random gifts and doing stuff. So I would say about 7:30. There's the web page is on attending.io. So if you look for that link in the show notes, attending.io/events/WAO-DEC16-meetup, and you'll find out there. And yeah, about 7 o'clock-ish, I would say, is probably about right, because we'll have gone for some food first. London Beer Dispensary, which is in Brockley in South London. So it'll be me, John Bevan, Brian Mathers, Laura Hilliger, Oliver Quinlan looks like he's coming along, some other people from our Slack channel, some ex-Mozilla people. Looks like it's going to be some fun, and there'll be some alcohol involved, and there we go.
Well, I was thinking about coming, but I have to balance. It's a journey for me, and I have to set off to get back. I'm getting down to Brockley. I think we'll take about 40 minutes from King's Cross on the train. It might just all prove too much.
Yeah.
Get back. We'll see. What am I doing? I have no idea what I'm doing. So I've been training Chromebook people today. That's been fun and productive and good. A good vibe about that. I'm currently surveying the lower six to see what tech they have, which is really interesting. Had some really interesting pushback on the idea of having one-to-one computers in lessons. So the purpose of the survey is to see
by,
what
by students.
Yeah, some really interesting things that people saying, like, I like not having my phone on me at school because it means it's the only time I don't have my phone out, kind of thing. Mm. And other things like that, the sort of difficulty of it, and they like having that time that's protected, not working on a computer.
Well, you know, Siddhartha Mitra, he explicitly says that you shouldn't do one-to-one stuff and that kids should share devices, doesn't he?
He does say that. And I think it's quite interesting. And so we have to do some evaluation. So we'll get once I've got 60, 70% of their feedback back. So once I've got 100%, if I ever get that far back, I'll take that for discussion with other people.
Okay.
But that's quite interesting. And that's all to kick off after Christmas. What else? I've been having meetings about Wi-Fi, learning about different kinds of Wi-Fi access points and how the aerials inside them work. And with the three different types of Wi-Fi signal of G, N, and AC, and how the different access points behave in different ways. So we're going to test some new ones out of those in a couple of boarding houses for a refresh of the school Wi-Fi and boarding house. And all of that, been dealing with pupils who are torrenting on the school networks. And because torrents and corporate networks don't play well together, mm-hmm. and they just sack all the bandwidth. So I've been dealing with a few pupils on that regard.
Could you do traffic shaping on them or not?
In what way do you mean? Sorry.
So traffic shaping is when, for example, BT notice which port you're using, and instead of blocking you, they just massively throttle your bandwidth.
Yeah, no, so throttling is an issue, and that's something that's what torrents don't allow, basically. They sort of bypass that. And yes, we do certain versions of throttling, but we're looking at how we can provide the best service. The issue for us is streaming. So we have a 300 megabit internet connection in two pipes that go straight down to London, and so the internet exchange down there. And we use that bandwidth all the time. So we have to look at how we can increase that, but it's very expensive. So we pay £22,500 per 100 megabit per year.
So when do you break up for Christmas?
I think we're 17th of December.
Right. So, yeah, that's only a couple. Is that the Wednesday? Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's like the Saturday, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the same time as my kids, actually. I just realized I didn't give any feedback, just for those who might have listened to last week's and then want to listen to this week's, and kind of as a follow-up. I think I said I was just about to go to Jersey, wasn't I? And I was going to visit that school, Doveurn School, which is a primary school.
Uh-huh.
And Amber Freer, you know, if Amber's listening, thank you very much for your time. Like, she gave of her time so generously in return for basically me just saying thank you a lot. Talking through her, you know, showing a new school build, all the wonderful facilities, the way that she is the sole admin on the accounts, manages stuff really well despite budgetary constraints. They've had a bring your own device thing for 10 years now. Google Apps, how it works with Outlook, all of the pros and cons and all that kind of stuff, and just really, really helped in terms of me thinking through what I should advise in terms of my clients.
Okay, and what did you come up with? So you just talked about Google Apps integrating with Outlook.
Well, what she said, and you know, I don't think I'm sharing any secrets here. She they've got a, like you, they've got Outlook for their main mail, and they've got Gmail, and they, because they're primary school, they just turn off Gmail, which I didn't know you could do in G Suite. I thought it was so central that you couldn't turn it off, but it turns out you can. It also means you have to get your notifications a different way. I don't think that's going to work for secondary school, just because the way things go, and at Victoria College, and I guess other schools as well, the advice is that you use your kind of Outlook mail for official business with other members of staff and parents and things, and then you use Gmail for student work.
Okay.
But the calendar issue was an interesting one, and still, I think, a bone of contention at that school, and they still haven't figured that out properly. And I think it's going to depend on people's context. I'm looking forward to going there actually tomorrow to see what the response is going to be to, apparently yesterday, a ship's anchor severed one of the two main cables that provides internet connection that goes from France to Jersey.
Oh, my gosh.
So maybe everything's on a go slow. I don't know.
It could be. That'd be interesting, testing of their systems. People must be in great panic getting that sorted. Interestingly, about this sort of, we don't have Gmail turned on at all in our installation. And the only place where Outlook does not work, which is also interesting that I have discovered, it is when you are in Google Classroom and you have an option to sort of highlight a few pupils, say they haven't done a piece of work or something, and then there's an email icon. When you click on the email icon, it wants to launch Gmail, and it will not redirect to Outlook. And that's the only place. So I would like to use Gmail because of the convenience. I think it's just a much better written email client than Outlook is, and Exchange in general. So I would like to use it, but the only place that it's actually a great inconvenience is that one right there.
Mm. Did you see that I wrote, sorry, this is now going on a bit at the end of the podcast. Do apologize, people who thought we were nearly at the end. Did you see that I wrote a digital kind of framework for G Suite, which was
I gave that a skim all the way through and thought it was really interesting, and I would revisit it. I thought it was good, though.
Well, just to explain where that came from, I did do it in much less time than you would usually. I think it's okay. Tim Jeffress gave it a thumbs up. He's at Oswestry. And Kerry Turner for Gogos on Twitter said it was pretty good, as did some other people. The reason I thought it might be a useful approach is that I was talking to Tom Barrett about this, who's now in Australia, consultant, wasn't Notosh, set up by himself, Dialogic Learning. Hi, Tom, if you're listening. We should get Tom on the podcast in 2017. He's a big fan of approaching mental models with school leaders, approaching kind of development and change management through mental models. And what I was trying to get at there, the solo taxonomy is basically trying to scaffold learning through increasing complexity and understanding the kind of three-dimensionality of the concept that you're introducing. It seems to me that Google have quite explicitly made Google Classroom a shiny, very easy to use front end for G Suite, which doesn't really involve a difficult mental model in terms of understanding how all the different apps relate to each other.
I might send this the way of people I've been training on the Chromebooks, and because we started with getting on Drive and dealing with admin and changing people's passwords, and then we just done a bit of Classroom today. But obviously this is a domino affected, as in a knock-on effect into all the apps, basically.
Yeah. Well, I've very explicitly, like I do with all my stuff, instead of saying it's version 1.0 when you release it, I've always do it the other way around. I say it's version 0.1. So it's very explicitly like, this is my first thinking on this. Yeah. And I've put a CC, Creative Commons license, on there with the agreement of my clients. So as I did with my City and Guilds work and everything, try and work as openly as possible. So very happy if people want to rip it apart. Actually, that would be quite valuable. And feel free to put comments on the Google Doc directly. Although, don't do personal attacks, because my client can see that as well. that's like a bad rag to a bull for die. He's going to just rip it apart.
All personal attacks directed at Doug's work email address as of the 1st of December, please. All right, brilliant. Well, I guess we should wrap this up. So you have a good Christmas. I'll speak to you elsewhere on anyway before.
But for those listening, our audience has grown significantly this year. I try not to look too much at the stats, but we're now regularly hundreds of people per week are listening to at least part of this. And some of the episodes, like Foucault, Your EdTech, have had thousands of listens. So I am quite amazed at that. And, you know, this is a vehicle for you and I having a regular conversation. The fact that anyone else listens is an absolute bonus. And I'm glad that so many people seem to think that our ramblings have value. Next year, I'd love to get more voices on here. We've had some voices, pre-recorded voices in this particular podcast. We might have people coming along live. I know Tom, who I've just mentioned before, Tom Barrett, has expressed an interest in coming on and having a chat. So maybe we can do more of that in 2017.
Yeah, yeah, why not? I'm open to anything. It's been a good year.
It has. All right, well, Merry Christmas and Jingle Bells and all that kind of stuff if you celebrate it. If not, then keep warm and see you in the new year.
Now I'm just going to sit at the dock of a bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, sitting on the dock of a bay, wasting time.